Hi, everyone. I'm glad to see you all here today. We have with us Professor Richard Banks from Stanford Law School. Today he's going to give a talk on anti-terrorism and police profiling, but he has a wide range of work, including articles on suspect selection and colorblind equal protection doctrine and discourse, as well as adoption and racial preferences. Currently, he's teaching employment discrimination, family law, and race and law at Stanford. And two things that bring him very close to my heart, he was an extensively published freelance journalist prior to law school. And as well, he's from my hometown, Cleveland, Ohio. So without any further ado, I bring for you Richard Banks.
Go Browns. Yeah. I have completely forgotten what I was going to say. I've been talking to, spoke with Nadja. This is amazing. You have great students here. This is a wonderful place to be. Thank you for having us. Really, it is a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to see all of you here. We passed around a couple of articles, which you don't have to read now, but do read later if you get a chance. And they both treat in a more systematic and complete fashion some of the issues that we'll talk about today. And what I'd like to do, we don't have much time, so what I'd like to do is to have a few, make a few comments by way of preface, and then pretty much have a discussion to see where we differ and where we agree, right, or where you're sort of with me as we go along. So, racial profiling anti-terrorism efforts. This is a big issue, has been a big issue since 9/11. Prior to 9/11, racial profiling was a big issue in the domestic policing context. In the context, just to, I don't know where, how far back everyone's memory goes, and I know there are people for whom this might seem a long time ago, but in the mid-1990s, there was a big controversy about racial profiling in the context of motorist stops. Is cops stopping motorists typically on highways, typically looking for drugs. Right, so these drug interdiction efforts led to wildly disproportionate stopping of African Americans and to some extent Latinos on highways. And people were very upset about the high rate at which African American and Latino motorists were stopped. One of the ways to combat this practice, and most of these people, of course, were innocent, right? Some weren't, but most of them were innocent. One of the ways to combat this practice was or the racial profiling movement arose in response to this practice and the abuses of this practice. And there were some very salient abuses, which you might recall. In New Jersey, for example, where a lot of the controversy focused, there was an incident where some cops stopped a van. The van was driving south. They stopped the van. They were basically looking for drugs. The guys didn't have drugs. They were college students. They were in a legitimate business. And they ended up being shot, right, by New Jersey State Troopers. And that was one of the issues that sort of galvanized people, right? So in response to those sorts of events, activists and scholars began to criticize law enforcement officers for, quote, racially profiling. And the idea was that the officers were stopping people on the basis of race because of stereotypes the officers had about who's more likely to be a drug courier, or who's more likely to be carrying weapons or doing something illegal. And this was an incredibly effective campaign, right? It started in the mid-90s over the span of a few years, right? Between 1995 or 96 and 2000, racial profiling efforts had spread across the country. Many jurisdictions enacted statutes that mandated data collection or that prohibited racial profiling outright. Law enforcement agencies got on board with this campaign and agreed that racial profiling was a bad thing, that they shouldn't do it, that if officers do it, they would be punished, that it's rank discrimination. Right? And this was such a big issue, right? It attracted such consensus that we saw candidates, presidential candidates on both sides of the divide supporting the prohibition of racial profiling. Right? George Bush said it was a bad thing. Al Gore said it was a bad thing. Bill Clinton said it was a bad thing. Everyone agreed that racial profiling was a bad thing that law enforcement officers should not do. So so that's the background. My I became suspicious when I saw that sort of agreement, right? So this is sort of first thing to think of is the first, one thing to keep in mind, right, is that whenever you see Democrats and Republicans agreeing too quickly about something, that's usually a cause that there's something else going on there. Right? There's actually something else going on, right? Be suspicious of that sort of agreement, right? It's not what it seems to be. So I begin to wonder, well, what's going on with this racial profiling issue? And what I concluded is that in the domestic policing context, the prohibition of racial profiling or the political opposition to racial profiling would do very little, in fact, to end the disproportionate stopping and searching that people were concerned about. So we have this political consensus, but there are a number of reasons that the political consensus is unlikely to be effective at ending abuses that people are concerned about. In the terrorism context, we see the same sort of problem writ large. So in the terrorism context, we have a debate, or we had a debate after 9/11 about whether racial profiling was appropriate. And you know, some people said, oh, you have to racially profile. Other people said no, and so forth and so on. And having thought about these issues in the domestic policing context, it seemed that the entire debate was sort of beside the point. That is, if you have lots of Arabs and Muslims who are being stopped, who are being investigated, right? You have anti-terrorism agents going on, and they're stopping people, they're investigating, and they're searching people at airports. They're doing all this sort of stuff. If you think that that's a bad thing, you might think that's a bad thing, but the fact that it's racial profiling or thinking about whether it's racial profiling won't help you to arrive at that conclusion. Let me put it another way. We have outcomes that out in the world, right? The result of the stop search practices of either cops on the highway or cops or anti-terrorism agents in the airport or homeland security agents who are working at the borders, and they're out there stopping people. If we know it's a bad thing, or if we're trying to decide whether it's a bad thing, asking ourselves the question, is it racial profiling? Is this racial profiling? It doesn't really help us to answer that question. So we don't get any analytical traction from the term racial profiling. It doesn't help you to answer the question. It is a powerful rallying cry, powerful political slogan. It has great metaphorical sort of resonance, right? It just seems like a bad thing, stereotyping writ large. So it has political salience, and has some emotional and rhetorical punch, but it doesn't have any or much. Actually, it doesn't have any, really. It doesn't have much analytical usefulness. All right, so what I want to talk about is, well, why doesn't it have any analytical usefulness? That's what I want to convince you all of today. That the idea of racial profiling is not useful or helpful in deciding whether a particular investigative technique or a particular pattern of stops and searches and seizures, whether all of that is good or bad or legal or illegal. It doesn't help you to make that decision. It might announce the judgment, right, or might say this is a bad thing, but in that case it's a label that we put on after the fact rather than the means of reaching that conclusion. Okay, so let me make it more concrete, because I know people here probably haven't done the reading. And you can ask some questions. Okay, so I'm going to use the blackboard. This is wonderful because, in the Bay Area, this is a downside of being in California, is that we don't have blackboards now. So now we have whiteboards, and you have these smart panels, and people have heard of that, and you have to know how to operate technology and so forth to get something on the board. But here you can just use chalk. This is great. So I'm going to take advantage of the chalk. So here we have this idea of racial profile. Right? And this might be, so racial profiling, the idea of racial profiling is that law enforcement officers are using race or ethnicity or religion or nationality, right? Some race or analog to race they're using that characteristic as the basis for stopping or searching someone, some investigative enforcement action. More specifically, they're relying on a profile, on a stereotype about the criminal propensities of that group member. So a cop who engages in racial profiling might say, right, if we make it really blatant, the cop would say, yeah, I stop, young black guys on the highway because I think they're more likely to be carrying drugs. I just think they're just prone to do that, right, more than other groups of people are. That's the case of racial profiling. But that's not the only way that cops might rely on race, because cops might also rely on race as a component of a suspect description. Okay, so the cop would use race in a suspect description when they have a description. Say a paradigm would be they have a description of a particular assailant, and the description, of course, includes race. So if someone takes a chalk, and the guy says, who does it? I say, well, it was the tall white guy who took the chalk. And when he goes out and tries to find the person who took the chalk, because I really missed his chalk, he's only going to stop the tall white guys, not the black guys or the women and so forth. All right, so that's the use of race in the suspect description. And that happens all the time, too. Now, any question? Everybody clear? So we have these two categories, right? One is impermissible, racial profiling. The other is permissible. Race is part of the suspect description. Both of these happen all the time. In the terrorism, and we can, I'm going to leave the drug interdiction context aside, but we can make the same sort of arguments that I'm about to make in drug interdiction, or similar arguments in the drug interdiction context, but let's focus on terrorism. So, in the terrorism context, when we say that a practice is racial profiling, we're saying that the agent, the decision maker, has used race in this way, not in this way. Right? That they've used race as part of a profile, stereotype about the propensity of a person based on their racial group membership, rather than race as part of a suspect description. In the terrorism context, though, it's incredibly difficult to actually distinguish these two categories. It's incredibly difficult to actually distinguish these two categories. And the sort of the, because so many of the, because the categories blur, many of the practices that might be characterized as racial profiling might also be characterized as suspect description reliance, or vice versa. Okay, so let me give anyone actually, maybe we'll take examples. If anyone has an example, so you're the chief of Homeland Security, and you just want to catch, well, imagine that you're channeling the chief of Homeland Security, right? You're channeling, you're sort of, you know, his spirit is flowing through your mind, right? So Michael Chertoff wants to stop the terrorist. How might he advise his officers to take account of ethnicity or religion or nationality? What might be one thing you would tell them to do? I mean, just give me an example to work. Who has an example? I mean, there are a gazillion of them. Yes?
Stop Nadja. All women wearing hijab.
Okay.
Ask them to do an extra search.
Right. Okay, extra search on women wearing hijabs. Okay, so that seems like I would clearly be profiling, right, if they were to do that. Sort of categorically stopping all members of this group because we think they're just more likely to be kind of affiliated with terrorists, right? And we should probably, though, I'm going to tweak the example a little because in practice, women, men are obviously the focus here. So let's say stop all men who are, who appear to be from certain countries where there are a lot of Arab Muslims. Okay. But we could do it with either. Okay, so we stop all the women wearing hijabs or all the men from these countries, and that would appear to be profile. But then let's say they tweak it a little, and they say, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to stop all the women wearing hijabs from these particular countries or all the men, the Arab Muslim men from these particular countries, and we're going to do that because You know, we know that people from those countries, those are countries where there's a high Al-Qaeda presence. And we have information that, you know, those countries are organized. They have organized Al-Qaeda groups. Now, if we do that, then it could seem like profiling, but then it might seem a little bit more like a suspect description as well. Right? And we would fill that out by saying that, well, if the cops are, if the cops are stopping people because of some stereotype about their group, that's the profile. But if, on the other hand, the cops are stopping people because they know, just as a factual matter, that there's a group out there that's committing crimes, and the group is selecting people for involvement or inclusion, for membership, based on their ethnic characteristics, then it might seem more like a suspect description. So let me give you another example to make that clear. So let's say someone comes in and they steal this chalk. Right? Individual, they steal the chalk. Cop goes out, uses my description, they find the individual. We know that's a suspect description. Now let's say, you know, an individual comes in, they steal the chalk, and or it's a group of people. You can come in, they steal this chalk, and this is going to get more outlandish. I'm going to talk about chalk. But they come in, they steal this chalk. It's a group of people, and we didn't really get a good view of any of those individuals. But we know that there's been this group going around at the law school here stealing chalk, right? There's like a law school gang, and their thing is to come in and steal chalk during lectures or something, right? And so we know there's this gang that does this, and this group had the same MO as the gang. So in that case, we don't have any description of an individual, but we do know that there was this particular criminal enterprise who stole the chalk. And then when we go out and we search, we might only look for people who we know are the type of people that that criminal enterprise would include. Right? So if we know that the criminal enterprise is all third-year students, we're only going to look at the third-year students. But we're not really profiling the third-year students, because we actually do have a description, in a sense we do have a description of the perpetrator, which is this criminal group, and it seems reasonable to take into account who the criminal group will allow to be members of that group. And if this criminal group is limited, has limited itself to third-year students, then we're only going to look at third-year students. And then when the third-year student says, you know, the 3L says, oh, you're profiling me based on my year in school, we say, no, we're not profiling you based on the year in school. We're only asking you whether, you know anything about this chalk theft, because we know that a particular group stole the chalk, and we know, as a fact, that this group only accepts third-year students as members of the group. Right? So it could seem like profiling to the student. But then again, profiling based on 3L status. But then again, it might seem like suspect description reliance to the extent we have a description of a particular criminal group who took the chalk. Right? So, okay. And people can, you can disagree with that, right? Okay. I'd like people to disagree, right? Voice dissenting opinions, right? So it could seem like either. And the very same, and so another way to generalize that is to say that when we talk about criminal enterprises or gangs who commit crimes, this distinction between racial profiling and suspect description reliance collapses. They seem discrete at first and separate, but when we think about gangs committing crimes, it's almost arbitrary whether we would characterize that use of race or ethnicity or a year in school as a form of profiling or as a form of suspect description reliance. Right. Another way to, yes.
I think I'm somewhat confused about this. Before you noted that the racial profiling is kind of based on like a stereotypical belief that then translates into certain factors that you're looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And suspect description is just these descriptions that you have from an incident that happened. Right. So in your case that you're giving of the 3L students, how does that fall under stereotyping? Because you have an observation, right?
Right. Right, with a three L.
Students that only has three L students in it, right? So wouldn't that just be a suspect description?
You said because the group only has three L students in it.
Yeah, is that what
right?
You said? Yeah.
Right. Well, from you, Wilson, what year in school are you?
What?
What year in school are you?
1L.
Oh, you're 1L. Okay, so let's say if it was a 1L group, right? Because you know 1Ls can get really, you know, just their 1Ls, right? And so so we think that, you know, 1Ls are, and these things, there have been incidents like this at schools, right, where there are things happening that are probably a result of anxiety and, you know, in a new environment, lots of pressures and lots of demands. So let's say you're sitting in class and the dean comes in and says, well, we want to have all the 1Ls come to the auditorium for a meeting. And 3Ls and 2Ls are excused, but all the 1Ls come. And we're going to talk to all you guys, try to figure out what's going on here. From the perspective of the 1L, you might feel like this is unfair. This is not right. What do you mean? I'm a good student. I do my homework. I do all the things that I should do. I read every day in class, and I brief cases, and I meet with my study group. I do all of that. Why am I under suspicion here? This is profiling based on year in school. And the dean would respond, no. We're not assuming that 1Ls are more likely to do bad things than anyone else. That would be sort of profiling you. We're saying that we had an actual incident. It was a visual observation of a specific incident. And we know for a fact that the group who did this was a group that calls themselves the UVA Chalk Stealers. And the UVA Chalk Stealers are a 1L group. We know that. We have, you know, intelligence information that tells us only 1Ls can be members of that group. So from the perspective of the dean, right, the dean would say, you know, this is reasonable, it's not unfair, we're just trying to find who stole the chalk. We know this group did it, and we know as a fact that the group only accepts 1Ls for membership, so we're only going to question the 1Ls. Why question the 2Ls and the 3Ls if we know they can't be members of this group based on the group's own requirements? So from the dean's perspective, it's just a matter of suspect description reliance. But if you have 1Ls who feel aggrieved by this, I mean, they're not going to say, oh, no, it's okay, it's fine. They're going to say, no, I didn't do anything wrong, profiling. And that actually illustrates how the same incident might be understood as, perceived as, felt to be either an instance of profiling or an instance of suspect description reliance. Right? So what your question highlights is that if you think it's okay, and I guess you would think that's okay to only question 1Ls if we know that there was a 1L group who took the chalk. Is that right? Fair to say?
Okay.
You think it would be okay?
Right.
Okay. So my point is, if you think it would be okay, you would say, this is just suspect description reliance. It's okay. But if you have a 1L friend who says, no, this is really unfair, then they're going to say it's profiling. They're using our membership in the 1L class and assuming that we did something wrong simply because we're 1Ls. Whereas my 2L friend who I study with is exempt from this. And they're going to say it's unfair. Now, in that case, the important point is that the judgment that it's profiling or suspect description reliance is it's an outcome of our intuition or reflection of our intuition about whether it's unfair or not. It's not the means by which we reach that judgment. So first we say it's unfair, and then we say it's profiling. We don't say it's unfair because it's profiling. This is the issue, actually, that is at play. This is a little, one of the readings that went around was a debate that I had with David Rudofsky, who's a very well-known and really great civil rights lawyer, who teaches at Penn. And we had this very issue. We sort of seized on this very issue of whether the characterization of the practice as racial profiling is the outcome of intuitions about fairness or whether it's the means of reaching that judgment about fairness. And my argument is that it's an outcome. So if you think it's unfair, you're going to say it's profiling, or your friend's going to say it's profiling. And then if you think it's okay, you're going to say, no, Johnny, it's not profiling. It's suspect description reliance. I mean, certainly we would allow them to do the same sort of thing if there was an individual and they knew that there was an individual who took the chalk and they were looking for the individual. Certainly that'd be okay. Okay, and the same sort of dilemma or situation arises in the terrorism context. Right, so let me just take it back to that just for a minute, right? So, so Chertoff says, okay, we're going to stop people from these countries because we're going to stop Arab Muslim people from these particular countries, whether it's women based on their headdress or, you know, men generally, And ACLU says racial profiling, bad thing. You know, you're not using race, but you're using characteristics that are equally bad. And church office say, yeah, but we're not really stereotyping. We're actually trying to stop Al-Qaeda, and we know for a fact that Al-Qaeda limits its membership to certain types of people, and we're going to only look in those groups of people because those are the people who can become members of Al-Qaeda, right? So a fundamentalist Christian might be a terrorist, but not a member of Al-Qaeda, right, in the eyes of the government, not a member of Al-Qaeda. So if we're searching for Al-Qaeda people, we're only going to look for certain types of people, and we're going to look in countries where we know that Al-Qaeda has an active presence and is doing active recruiting and so forth, or where the government shelters Al-Qaeda members. That has nothing to do with stereotyping those people. It's just that we're trying to disrupt this criminal gang, and it's more akin to suspect description reliance. Yes?
It strikes me that you made a shift in the scenario when you addressed a question that it may seem subtle, but it significantly changed the way I would feel about both my assessment of fairness and how I got to that. And that is that when you presented the scenario, I mean, albeit just chalk, you said that someone took the chalk, period. We know that there's this gang of third years that fits this MO.
Correct.
That to me is very different than saying you responded to her with, we know that this group did it, that this group of three L's committed the chalk offense, because in the making it analogous to like terrorism, if a terrorist attack, some sort of event takes place, and it fits the Al-Qaeda MO, it makes a different sort of sense to then look for people that look like what we think Al-Qaeda looks like than it is for Al-Qaeda to claim responsibility for it.
Right.
And then narrowing in becomes a very different thing.
Right. No, that's true. So in some sense, right. That's a great point. So there's a little gap, right? So two different possibilities. One is that we know for sure that Al-Qaeda did it. And the other is that, well, we think this is the sort of thing that Al-Qaeda might do. And there you might say, well, we are sort of stereotyping the group because something bad happened and we think that it's Al-Qaeda rather than some other group, right? So there might be some aspect in which we're stereotyping the group. But that re-raises the same sort of blurriness between stereotyping on one hand and suspect description reliance on the other, right? Because in any sort of case, you know, there's going to be uncertainty about whether, in any case, there's uncertainty, right, in terms of what we know. So, you know, in the Al-Qaeda case, let's say they, you know, they bomb, something bad happens. A building blows up, and we go into the building, we find a note saying, courtesy of Al-Qaeda. Now, there we know, right? So then it would clearly be suspect description reliance. At the other extreme, we might have a bad thing happen, and we just assume, well, this was Al-Qaeda, right? There was some chemical that was leaks into the air, and we assume it's Al-Qaeda, when in fact it might be an accident, or it might be some other group, or who knows what happened, right? But then, more likely, we're going to have these intermediate cases. Bad thing happens, and, you know, Osama takes credit for it. Now, that could mean that Al-Qaeda really did it, or it could mean that Osama wants to just take credit for it, right? And so there's always going to be some uncertainty about whether, there will often be some uncertainty about whether this group did it. So, and that's kind of the most common case, right, where things happen and, you know, how certain are we that this group actually did it? Well, sometimes we're really certain, sometimes we're less certain. But that continuum of certainty is still on the same spectrum between suspect description reliance on one hand and stereotyping or profiling on the other. So that's a great example, but it re-raises the same issue, right? And the issue, again, is that we have these two categories. They seem distinct, but in the terrorism context in particular, most cases are actually going to sort of fall between these two, right? One way in which that happens is that we're investigating this criminal enterprise. When we're investigating the criminal enterprise, it sort of seems like profiling, because we are stopping people, and we're only going to stop people of, you know, if you're looking for, you know, if a gang member is shot in L.A. and you know that the Bloods did it, and the Bloods are African-American gang, you're only going to stop African-Americans. You just are. You're not going to stop anyone who's not African American as a member of that gang. And that sort of kind of seems like profiling. But then again, we do know that there was a crime that was committed. We do know this gang did it. And we do know that this gang only has members who are African American young men. They don't have women, they don't have whites, they don't have Latinos. But then we have uncertainty sometimes about whether the gang did do it. And then we have the same, we see the same dynamic at play in those cases. If you think that there was, that in the case of, let's say the 3L case again, or the 1L case, let's make it the 1L case. I think 1Ls are more likely to do, 3Ls are more thinking about graduation, 1Ls are more likely to do bad stuff while they're here. Now that's a case of stereotyping. That's stereotyping. Okay, but so in that case, again, if you think that the thing that happened was really bad and we really need to find the person who did it and that it's not unfair to bring all the 1Ls in and question them, you're going to say, well, you know, it was, we weren't completely certain that this group did it, the 1L gang did it. But we do know there is this 1L gang, and we do know these other things that happened were done by the 1L gang, and so we're just going to think that that's more a case of suspect description and reliance. Whereas if you think it's really objectionable, and you think how unfair to bring all the 1Ls in and question the 1Ls, you're going to say that's profiling because I'm innocent, and why should I be questioned, and my friend who's a 2L isn't questioned, and in fact, they're not even certain that the 1L gang did it. I mean, you know, what's the real proof? And then you're going to emphasize all of that, and you're going to say that's more like profiling. And the point is that not that one is correct. They're both correct. I mean, they're both sort of sensible, logical, intuitive. But which seems more sensible, logical, intuitive to you will depend on, I think, how fair or unfair you think the investigation of the individuals is. And that judgment, in turn, will depend on the seriousness of the crime and then what the investigators are doing and, you know, all sorts of other factors. Okay. Yes.
My issue is efficiency. Like, if you're trying to figure out who stole the chalk, I mean, instead of just grouping all the 1Ls together, how much just takes more time to figure out specifically the characteristics or, you know, for example, with the gang situation, just like knowing that the Bloods are African American, like, it takes so much more time to round up all the African Americans. Like, you know, okay, they live within this four blocks radius, they wear pink shoes or something, something more specific. I mean, I feel like it's just, you know, wasting time.
Right.
And resources trying to, like, round up the larger groups of people living there and the specific individuals we're looking for.
Right, and that might be right. That's a fair criticism, right? So you would say that's a fair criticism that, you know, this practice is objectionable because it casts too broad a net, it investigates too many people, you know, the likelihood of a true positive is pretty small. That's fair, but that has nothing to do with whether it's racial profiling, suspect description, reliance.
Right.
So I agree, yeah, that's a fair point, right? But it has nothing, it doesn't turn on whether it's racial profiling, suspect description, reliance at all. And this analysis that you're suggesting be undertaken, that analysis is not aided by trying to decide, is it racial profiling or is it suspect description reliance? That analysis that you're suggesting is a good way to think about it. And you can think about that without ever trying to answer this question. Mm-hmm. It's a different sort of question. Right? Okay, but let's take that a step further. So let's say or just to dramatize that. You know, one of the things that happened in the aftermath of 9/11 was that that airport security personnel were stopping lots of people. Right? We heard all the stories, and people were asked to get off of planes and not allowed to get onto planes, and, you know, subjected to very intensive scrutiny. And one might say, oh, that's a bad thing because it's racial profiling, right? Or profiling on the basis of ethnicity or language or nation of origin, whatever, right? You know, it could be. Let's imagine that the, you know, the airline officials respond, right? This is what they did respond. They responded by saying, you know, well, we have a no-fly list. No-fly list is a list based on, you know, FBI evidence, right? Or the, you know, sort of intelligence information about terrorists. We got 20,000 names on the no, 10,000 names on the no-fly list. And these are all people who are known to be terrorists, who affiliate with terrorists, who are suspected of being terrorists, suspected of supplying support to terrorist groups, right? All those categories we would all acknowledge are relevant. And then the airline people said, so we're just going to stop people who seem to match this key characteristic. So in one sense, this is narrowing the search. They say, we're not going to stop everyone from Saudi Arabia, but if there's someone traveling whose last name is Bin Laden, I mean, you know, come on. They're actually, someone's going to question them individually. We can't allow someone with the last name of Bin Laden and a big sealed up package to get on a flight, right? Can't happen. That's clearly sort of suspect description reliance, right? We know there is someone out there named Bin Laden, and we're not going to allow that person to fly without being questioned. But then the moment you allow that, and this seems to start off as very narrowly targeted, the moment you allow that, then it results in the very same outcome of stopping thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people, maybe half the population, right, from some of these countries as, quote, suspected terrorists. And it starts to seem a lot more like a paradigmatic case of profiling, right? So imagine here if we were, you know, if the terrorist was, imagine if Bin Laden is the equivalent of Smith, right? Or, you know, other names that are common among terrorists are very common among the broader population. So that even relying on something as specific to a person as someone's name means that you're going to stop a huge percentage of the population. Now, again, and this happens a lot, right? Again, that could seem like profiling, because you might stop 20% of a group from a particular country, right, or this sort of religious ethnic group. You might stop 20, 30, 40% of the group, or 20, 30, 40% of the men in the group at least. So it kind of seems like profiling. But then again, it kind of seems like, well, gosh, they're acting upon your recommendation and relying on very specific information, someone's name. So it kind of seems like suspect description reliance in that case. And this is what happens, obviously, in the war. This is not a stretch. This is what happens in the war on terrorism, right? And that is the issue that's been debated. Airport stops and stops by Homeland Security agents of lots of people, sometimes on the basis of very specific information, but which nonetheless leads to stops of lots of people. Could be profiling, could be suspect description reliance. Which you think it is not a matter of sort of, you know, some meta, you know, some high level or abstract definition of the categories. It's probably going to depend on your intuitions about fairness. So now that case, I mean, just to bring back, since you wanted specific information, so the Homeland Security people say we're going to stop people based on their name. Right. If you have a name that matches the name in our terrorist database, and we got 10,000 names in the terrorist database, and we're doing the best we can to make sure that we only have names in the terrorist database that are the names of actual terrorists, and there are 10,000 of them. We cannot let them enter the nation. ACLU complained, this is just like profiling. This is just a proxy for profiling. Airlines say, we got to do it, right? You don't want to fly with someone named Bin Laden who hasn't been scrutinized, right? Your response is what? What do we do?
Well, I'm thinking about, okay, so racial profiling is an assessment someone from the outside makes, sort of their reaction to it, not knowing, well ACLU is aware that, you know, the government has narrowed it down. But I feel like...
Well, they're saying the government hasn't narrowed it down. They're saying it's stopping thousands of people.
Well, they know that they're just doing it based on last names that have been associated with terrorists. Right. But I just feel like one's understanding of, you know, fairness is sort of, I think, would be tied into whether or not they think that whoever's doing this has a justified reason for doing it, where it's not like, you know, not justified that we want to stop, you know, terrorist acts, but justified in that we did our research, and according to what we found, this is the family that's sort of involved in terrorism. That will impact how I view sort of my sense of fairness in assessing whether or not it's racial profiling. So I don't know. I mean, I guess the ACLU would just say it's racial profiling because just going by names, you know, Bin Laden is a very common name, Saudi Arabia. It's just, you know, proxy for just saying Arab people from Saudi Arabia. But I think, like, going back to, you know, assessing racial profile from the outside and saying this is what it looks like rather than what it actually is, my sense of fairness is based on whether or not I think their methods for arriving at whether or not it's racial, whether or not this is the kind of people we're going to screen. That's, like, tied to my sense of justice and fairness.
Okay, so you'd want to know, well, did they really call from the list all the names that maybe aren't the names of terrorists? Are they actually, are they taking into account other information that would also help to sort of narrow the field of suspects, country of origin, and your travel dates and age and all that sort of stuff? Are they taking all that into account? And then you might also want to know, well, what are they actually doing once they stop someone? Right? What if they stop someone whose name is Bin Laden, and Bin Laden can show, he's obviously not Osama Bin Laden, he can show that he's a businessman who works for an American company and was doing business in Saudi Arabia and so on. How do they treat the person? How quickly do they release them? What sort of indignities are they subjected to? You might want to consider all of that in trying to decide whether we think this is fair or not. Again, that doesn't involve this question of whether it's racial profiling. Suspect description reliance doesn't help us to answer any of those questions. It's a label we put on after the fact, but it's not the way that we reach our conclusion. Yes? You have a question? Yes.
Okay. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to just kind of zero in on one here. Let's just take, for the sake of argument, your assertion or argument that racial profiling, the term at least, is not a useful concept in terms of analysis. There clearly are harms that are perceived from a variety of perspectives, some relating to the effectiveness of law enforcement, at least in the drug context. The argument was made that it was not good community relations, it was not good community policing. There was the sense, there was the argument made that there were a lot of false positives, which was alluded to earlier, so a lot of people, there was a differential impact, an asymmetrical impact in terms of a burden on some people who were innocent. There's the whole issue of group perception, the sense that it's a harm to a particular group. How does the government, in the current environment, how does the government reduce, I mean, regardless of what we call it, and I would say that most people would agree, that we have a unique thing, because it's not really suspect description in most cases. We're actually trying to identify potential law violators. We're trying to keep out potential terrorists. So it's kind of a combination of law enforcement and investigation and that type of thing. How do we deal with these potential harms and still meet the objectives that we have as a country to try to deal with terrorism?
Right. Well, that's a big question. that's a very big question. So I think you're right. So you started out by saying that I'm saying, this is corrected, racial profiling is not an analytically useful term, analytically useful category. Right? It is politically useful and rhetorically powerful, so it has that punch, but it's not analytically useful. It doesn't help us to sort practices into the good and desirable and the bad and undesirable. There are some problems that you highlighted, which occur both in the terrorism context and in the drug interdiction context, right? And so critics have argued that law enforcement's tactics are bad for community relations, right? People begin to distrust the police, that they disproportionately stop lots of innocent people, right? So you have what we call false positives, that people are stopped. We think they're criminals, but they're not criminals, they don't have drugs, they're not terrorists, and they're subjected to the same sorts of bad treatment that they would have been subjected to had they actually been a terrorist, right, short of being kept in jail. And then there's also the widespread perception that certain groups are more likely to be engaged in criminal activity, whether it's terrorism or drug smuggling and sales. And those are all problems. Those problems, though, should not be understood as problems of racial profiling, right? There's no logical link between those problems and racial profiling. So in the terrorism context, you can imagine precisely those same problems if the cops say, all we will do is stop people who have the same name as a terrorist or respond, say, to complaints by citizens, tips that we get, right, about terrorist activity. That's all we're going to do. We're not going to make any judgment about who's likely to engage in terrorist activity. That seems sort of stereotyping. We're just going to stop people who match some specific information of a specific terrorist, and then we're going to respond to tips that you guys give us about terrorist activity. If they just do that, we could have all those same problems, even though they're genuinely doing their best not to profile and to be on the suspect description side. Same sort of issue could arise in the drug and addiction context, which you raised, right? So if you have drug activity out in the world that actually differs across racial groups, right? So if you have more drug use in poor, or more drug dealing, say, in poor inner city areas than you do in suburban areas, then the cops are going to go to the poor inner city areas, and that's where they're going to go look for drug dealers. And that could lead to all the same problems that you identify, even if the cops say, genuinely, you know, we're not even thinking about race. We're just waiting to see when the neighbors call in and say, there's somebody on the corner dealing drugs, come get them. And then we go look for the person. Even if that's all we do, we could still have all of these same problems. So all of this is to say that in thinking about how to address those problems, my sort of first comes a negative claim. In thinking about how to address those problems, thinking about the divide or the distinction between profiling on the one hand and suspect description reliance on the other is not helpful. That's not the way to think about it. What is the way to think about it? Well, that's a really big question, but we would want to start by thinking about you know, how serious is the crime or the harm that we're trying to avoid, right? So, you know, you might think that drug addiction is, or drug interdiction is not, that the drug war itself is on somewhat questionable foundations, right? So we might think that the harm is clearly not as great as the harm of terrorism. And then we'd also want to think about the consequences for individuals and for communities of our enforcement actions or of our efforts to try to deal with the problem. You know, one of the common approaches here would be that to note that when people are stopped or searched, their experience of being stopped or searched doesn't depend so much on, you know, either their frequency of being stopped or searched or, you know, the reasons that they were stopped or searched so much as how they were treated when they were stopped or searched. So if I had one thing to tell, you know, law enforcement agencies, right, and Homeland Security people, it would be to try to treat people well. And if you treat people well, actually, they're less likely to think that what happened was unfair, hence racial profiling, and they're more likely to say, well, yeah, I know you are looking for some bad guys who did this and I can understand, but you treated me kindly, right, and you understood that I'm innocent until proven guilty. And if you treat people in that way, that makes a big difference. Right. So if there's one suggestion, that's it. Treat people well. And it sounds sort of squishy and kind of touchy-feely. But there actually is a lot of research behind this, known generally as a procedural justice research, which shows that people's experiences with law enforcement agencies and other agencies and their sense of fairness depends a lot on their sense about the fairness of the procedure, sort of how did things happen, not simply whether they were stopped, whether they were searched, whether they were found guilty, and so forth. Okay, yes. And we got about five more minutes. Three more minutes.
New class starts.
Okay, three more minutes.
Sorry. Well, I apologize, we might not have a class, but you may have already addressed this, but I'm just questioning if racial profiling has already become a relatively accessible term within academia and even common discussion, why it can't in some way instead of trying to reframe our conception of whether we categorize certain actions in one of those two boxes, why not reframe how the term itself is used since it's already gained, I think, a certain level of accessibility. People understand that there are different levels of fairness
right.
that are being conducted and some having to do with preventing crimes and some
right.
have to do with enforcing the laws for people who've already committed crimes, but I think that racial profiling does capture to a certain extent the prevention element, which is mm-hmm. directly related to the war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really understand what the greater good of, I guess, throwing it away as an analytical term, if it has, I think it has, like, it has a political significance and it has, like, a layperson relevancy that some other terminology or analytical set, you know, language may not have.
Right, right. So it does. So let me just, I don't want to throw it away, right? I'm not saying we should throw it away. I'm just saying we should be clear about how it can and should be used, right? So if you're, you know, an advocate and you want to gather a community to talk about police abuses and mistreatment, you can talk about racial profiling, right? That'll get people to come to the meeting, right? You're talking about racial profiling. You want to hear the community's experiences with racial profiling. And that's fine. Right, you're an advocate. You want it to have a. You want the term to have. You want to use the rhetorical impact and the emotional wallop of the term. But if you're the cop, right, or the police chief, right, or the analyst trying to figure out, well, how should we deploy officers? What should we do? You know, who should we stop? All of that stuff. Thinking about whether the practice is racial profiling is not going to be useful. is not going to be. So it can't help you to answer any of the questions that you need to answer.
We want to check some of your assumptions, given that race is in it, and it's already a strong term. So as a police officer, even incorporating that in the way that you process how you're evaluating the systems that you're going to use to prevent crimes, I think
that could be good too. So you could say that you could have the same sort of consciousness raising with cops that you would have with the community group, right? Or with terrorism officials. So we got like one more minute here, right? Yes.
Half seconds, go ahead.
30 seconds, right? So you could have the same sort of consciousness raising with law enforcement officers or government officials as with community people. So, if you're the chief of police, you could tell your cops that we're opposed to racial profiling. We want you to be aware of racial profiling and the problems that have led to the anti-racial profiling campaign and the things that people are concerned about, both in the drug addiction context and in the terrorism context, and why this is a bad thing. You can do all of that. And that raises the consciousness of your agents, of the law enforcement folks. I've seen that happen, and that's a good thing. But then inevitably, you have someone say something like, a woman, this happened in the terrorism context, a woman called in a tip, right? Some of you might remember this a few years, but she called the state police in Florida somewhere and said, I heard these guys sitting in Denny's, they were talking about bringing a bomb down to blow up something, and they were Arab, and they said they're going to bring this bomb, and they're going to blow up this building, and, so forth and so on. And the cops, of course, said, gosh, we got to stop them, right? And she got the license plate number of the car. And so she goes out, and so they go. The cops go out and they surround these people. And of course, it turns out that one of the guys is in medical school, and the other person is a businessman. And she actually misconstrued their conversation, and they weren't actually talking about blowing anything up and so forth. And so that kind of situation comes up, and the cops have to think, well, gosh, how do we deal with that situation? And you could think of that as profiling, because the woman was sort of stereotyping them based on their appearance, right? You had these three sort of Arab-looking guys, and she was stereotyping them. But then again, it seemed like a suspect description reliance from the standpoint of the law enforcement officers, right? Because they were responding to the tip that the woman gave them, and they were specific people who they were looking for. So that's just one example where you think, well, gosh, how should we deal with that, right? How should we respond to tips that people have? And we can't answer that, really practically important question through a commitment not to engage in racial profiling. It just doesn't help us, right? So rhetorically potent, metaphorically useful, but not analytically useful. Doesn't answer practical policy questions that arise both in the drug addiction context and in the terrorism context. Okay.
Well, thank you very much.